Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the More Phenomenal Hockey Show. It's I, Michael, and I'm being joined by Rob Del Mundo, who writes for covering the PWHL for HockeyHotStove.com and is also part of Rogers up in Canada. Rob, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, and real quick before we hop into things, the More Phenomenal Hockey Show is brought to you by Oats Overnight. When we're on the go but still need breakfast, Oats Overnight is the healthy on-the-go breakfast choice for the show and TXHT Hockey. Use our exclusive link in the description on both TXHTHockey.com and in the YouTube show description to get a $20 discount on Oats Overnight today. So with that out of the way, Rob, as we were talking about briefly, we're going to be talking about the PWHL, the Professional Women's Hockey League, currently in their third season, and kind of going into that home stretch as the season will end at the end of April. All the teams have played 22 games so far this season. What are your overall thoughts before we go into each team individually? What are your overall thoughts on the season so far?
Well, I think a lot of the narrative going in was the expansion draft process and the upheaval of all the original six rosters and the expectation from myself included, who was one of several critics of the expansion process in which each of the original six teams could protect only
Three
three
players.
players. Was that Vancouver and Seattle, the expansion cousins in the Northwest, would have unfairly stacked rosters. But here we are, like you said, with 22 games left in the season, each team has 8 games remaining. That did not happen. So you look at the basement of the standings, and Vancouver and Seattle are the seventh and eighth playoff teams of neither team is expected to make the playoffs unless they have a really meteoric run. So I guess that's the biggest for me, it was a surprise. I mean, it's like, expansion teams, like you expect them like bottom feeders for like most major sports league, whereas the PWHL, because it has a different model, because the Walter Group owns all eight teams, so to speak, it's not really, so to speak, a professional league, in which case, the new kids on the block have to go through their growing pains. And I guess I could understand why they wanted it that way. But, going into the season, I think a lot of people thought that each of the original teams protecting three players was too few. So now, having said that, as we said, maybe we'll go into each one individually, but Vancouver and Seattle really haven't gelled to the point where they would compete for a playoff spot, as many critics, myself included, thought they would be. So it seems like at the top three, they'll finish, between Minnesota, Boston, Montreal in that top three. Let's say, all things being equal, Vancouver, Seattle would be on the outside looking in. So now for that four seed, you've got basically three teams, Toronto, Ottawa, and New York, competing for that fourth and final spot. So it should be very interesting down the stretch.
Yeah, and I was also a critic of it because I believe it's like they were able to protect three players, and then once they had four players selected by either Vancouver or Seattle, they were then able to protect a fourth player,
Yes.
which was a very interesting way. And like a lot of people said, as you said, there's a lot of critics to it. It kind of gave the vibe of like what the NHL did for Vegas when they came into the league. It was very friendly for the Vegas Golden Knights, and as we saw, they were pretty much a playoff contender going to the Stanley Cup final their first year, winning the Stanley Cup in their fifth year. They were an immediate impact team right off the bat, whereas where you look at the Seattle Kraken, not really kind of the same success that Vegas had, because the lead or the general managers were like, the Vegas one did not work out I mean, yeah, it was great for Vegas, but it wasn't great for the rest of the league. So that's why it got pulled back for Seattle. And with their talk of being more expansion, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that could be a point of conversation where it's like the teams kind of go, hey, this wasn't really the best way to kind of go about it. You know, would that be an agreed sentiment?
Yeah, well, it's more to the point of like the optics of yeah, like I said, because it's a bit different, because it's not like, privately owned individual franchises as opposed to trying to do what's best for the league as a whole, PWHL. You could sort of see why they wanted Vancouver and Seattle to be competitive, but the bigger picture, it was destroying the fan bases. It's like, especially going into year three. Where let's take, I'm just going to use the team that I cover here in Toronto, the Scepters, as an example, even though all the original six teams had to go through this. It's like you have Toronto, let's say, Sarah Nurse, has been like the face of the franchise for like, two seasons. Maybe she's not the most productive player, or like, I mean, she's in the top three, but maybe not necessarily the top scorer, but she's in the mix. However, because she's very marketable, she's on the cover of EA Sports and everything else, so but in terms of image and fan base, Sarah Nurse is to Toronto what, for example, like Hillary Knight would be to Boston. And so even though let's say, for example, if you can only protect three players, then Toronto isn't going to protect Sarah Nurse over it's core three over there, a Turnbull, Fast, and Watts. But for example, and it's like it's the same thing with Boston, where you have to do what's best for the team in protecting their core three. But Hillary Knight, the defending, co-MVP or co-leading scorer, should not be unprotected in a draft. So it's more towards for the original six. It was more towards the fan base, the fans, who buy the tickets and buy the jerseys of their favorite players. Actually, I have to say sweaters because I'm Canadian. The sweaters are their favorite players, and now all of a sudden it's like after only two seasons, then the rest is history. Nurse signs with Vancouver, Hillary goes to Seattle, and so it's more of upsetting the core fan base in year three, where the league is trying to establish its footing for the NHL, for the private league. Individual private teams, you can make a case here or there, but it's more to the point of the league, the PWHL is only going into year three, so why would you upset that balance after only two seasons for each individual original six franchise?
Yeah. So we're going to hop right into the teams, starting with the first place Boston Fleet. It's kind of ironic. Boston's always been kind of near the top of the heap. It's almost like the NWHL PHF days where the Boston Pride were always at the very top of that league, being three-time Isabel Cup champions. And you mentioned Hillary Knight leaving for Seattle. A lot of people thought that Boston was going to struggle mightily with the loss of Hillary Knight and some of the other players that they lost, but they've been fantastic this season, really led by Erin Frankel in goal, who just recorded her sixth shutout of the season recently. What are your thoughts on the Boston Fleet and how they've been doing this season? And, can they keep the top spot going into the playoffs?
Well, it's very meteoric, and of course it starts with Erin Frankel in goal, as you said, and she and Debian in Montreal, co-leaders among save percentage. I think Frankel has more wins with 15, but Frankel, of course, and of course I mentioned those two for a reason. I mean, they're at the top of their games, and we saw that even in Milan, Italy, where to no one's surprise, Franklin and Debian do it for the. For the gold medal. But no, it starts with Franklin in net. And yep, you have to before we even like go through the rest of the roster, you have to hat tip to a Chris Spahr. I mean, the job that he's done just in terms of molding the team. I mean, no disrespect to outgoing coach Courtney Kessel, who's like, I mean, formidable in their own right. Assistant coach for the Team Canada Women's World Championship back when the most recent time that they won. But Chris Spahr has just managed to just I like to your point about Boston losing their key players like Knight, like Alina Mueller, but has been able to mold what he's got remaining on that roster, building from Franklin Franklin Frankel out, and Boston just hasn't missed a beat. Got off to that strong start and just haven't looked back. So, can they hold the top spot? Well, it's you have to think of them as a driver's seat because I know we'll get to Montreal in a second, where because Montreal's going to be hampered by the loss of MPP. So I mean, but it's really tight up front because I'm looking at the standings now. Boston leads Minnesota by 3 points, so that's a regulation win for all intents and purposes. But yeah, for sure. I mean, you'd think the to be cliche, but if the road to the Walter Cup would go through Boston, then they seem pretty strong.
Yeah, and we have seen that Boston was the team that the road to the Walter Cup was 2 years ago when Minnesota defeated Boston in the Walter Cup championship for the first of their two championships so far. As you mentioned, the Montreal Victoire, they're without their captain Marie-Philippe Poulin due to injury, but they do have their stalwart goaltender, and Renee Desbien, blanking on the name, even though it's right there in
That's
front
all
of
right.
me. It just
Debian.
happens. It's like it's right there in front of you, and you just blank. But Montreal has had a very stellar season. Looks like they are, they're definitely in that driver's seat to make it to the playoffs as well. What have you seen that has been very particular for the Victoire that has made them once again for another season a very dominant team?
I'll get to that in 2 seconds. I just want to correct something I said. When I said Alina Mueller leaving for Boston, of course I was talking about Hannah Bilke going to Seattle. So when I said it, that didn't come out right. No, Boston was not going to let Alina Mueller go. So my bad. But in terms of Montreal, I think what you saw, especially in the off season, was like a having them bulk up a bit in terms of their acquisitions. Just the players like maybe like they might not be household names like Maggie Flaherty or Jade Downey-Landry. Just they got more physical. I mean, I think they were like favorites in the previous 2 seasons, but then they seemed to get pushed around a bit. So Daniel Sauvageau, went out and got some signed these players. I think we can get to throw Maureen Murphy's name in there too. So, I mean, of course, the spotlight, rightfully goes to MPP and Laura Stacey and Aaron Ambrose. But then you've got these grit players that, are going to stand up to their opponents and not get pushed around. So I think the narrative around Montreal was to get more physical, and it's paying off. And of course, that, that trade where Abbey Rock was, obtained from the, New York Sirens with Kristen O'Neill going the other way. Just both players needing a fresh start, but then you put Rock on that Montreal roster next to those players that I have mentioned on, or at least on the same roster, and that's why Montreal's got all that sandpaper. It's their quote unquote the year three identity.
Now, of course, they're 2 points behind the Boston Fleet, 1 point ahead of the Minnesota Frost. Do you see them kind of staying in that two spot, or do you think they could potentially usurp without Poulin in the lineup, the Boston Fleet for that first spot?
Well, it's going to be tough. I mean, you can't underestimate the loss of MPP, but I guess they'll just come back to goaltending again. I mean, it's if Desbien can steal a few games here and there, like I mean, between her and Frankel, as we just mentioned, 1-2, it'll be tough. It depends on the extent of Poulin's injury, but then again, Montreal's got a great defense as well. I mean, I'm just looking at the stats here: 32 goals against, which is best in the league. I mean, all eight teams having played the same number of games. Montreal's a 2-goal edge on Boston, giving up two fewer goals for tops in the league in that department. And so you build from Desbien out, and they're the defense. And Nicole Gosling, just a great rookie, just a great draft pick by Montreal there. And then of course Ambrose is the rock, although she got hurt in the Olympics, of course. But yeah, I mean, between Poulin and Ambrose's absences, it's going to be tough to usurp Boston, but then with Debian in that, you just never know.
Yeah. Next up, we got the Minnesota Frost. This was a team a lot of people were freaking out about going into the expansion draft. They lose a good hunk of that championship defense to Seattle and Vancouver. People were like, how could they let Claire Thompson go? How could they let Sophie Jox go? And, a few others. But Ken Klee and his coaching staff have actually done a very good job this season for the Frost. They're also not in a way slumping like they have the last 2 years coming out of a break, which has been something that they've always had an issue with coming out, and they've always had to squeak into the playoffs. What are some of the differences that you've noticed with the Minnesota Frost, especially with them having 8 games left in their, well, I mean, every team has 8 games left, but with the Frost and their 8 games left this season?
Well, I think it's they've been able to come over overcome, pardon me, as you said, the loss of a Claire Thompson and Sophie Jakes, who weren't just, the rock horses on Minnesota's defense. They were like Renata Fast was Defender of the Year, but Claire Thompson and Sophie Jakes were the co-runners up. So as you said, to lose both to expansion, which, speaks to the flaws in the process that we discussed at the top of the show, we just figured or a lot of people figured, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with the with the Frost? But then to bring it back in terms of their identity, what's been different? Well, I mean, I'm just taking a quick look at the skater stats in terms of points and who we got here. It's like, Kelly Ponick, Britta Curl, Taylor Heise are the co-leaders. All of them play for the Minnesota Frost, and all of them co-lead the league with 22 points. 3 points more than their next competitors, both from Ottawa, but they've just, if there's been overcoming the losses on the blue line, they've more than made up for it with their offense. So, and as you said, to your point about the slow start, especially, I mean, I recall last season where the Frost did not qualify for the playoffs until that chaotic, final day of the regular season. And then all of a sudden, it's like they just seem to turn on the jets. It's like, okay, well, we're here now. Let's have the a great 2 round run over here. And it's like, I just remember the first season, Taylor Heise kind of like gets off to a slow start. Then in that Walter Cup final against Boston, she just takes over, and all of a sudden she's like scoring in bunches. And then fast forward to last year, where it's like they seem to accelerate at the right. In April. So this year, their identity, kind of in addition to all the scoring prowess, is that we're not going to just wait until April to turn on the Jets. We're going to we're just going to score a bunch of goals. And it's like, if you take a cursory look at the goals for, they have 67 goals in 22 games. The next closest competitor is Montreal in second place with 56 goals, Boston with 51. So, pardon me, Ottawa with 53, then Boston in fourth place with 51. So the Frost have 11 more goals than their next closest competitor, by far the most in the league. So they're just doing it with their scoring up front.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is that, like, as we mentioned, they had to squeak their way into the playoffs both years. Like they kind of say, be good enough to get into the playoffs because you're really built for the playoffs. So, as we've seen also, like with, teams like, say, Tampa Bay Lightning and Florida Panthers in the NHL, they don't necessarily need to be the first t place team in their division or conference. They just need to make the playoffs, and then that's when they excel. So, and I can say that that's pretty good comparable for how we can view the Minnesota Frost. They don't need to be first place in the league, whatever. They just need to be in the playoffs because they're built for it.
But they are challenging for one. Like I said, we said only one regulation win between behind Boston, so anything can happen between now and the end of April.
Next up, we have the Toronto Scepters, which is the jersey that I'm wearing on the show for those watching, and the team that you had mentioned earlier that you cover in particular. They're in fourth place, and this is where the drop kind of comes that you alluded to earlier in the show. They have 31 standing points, so they're holding that fourth and final playoff spot right now. Reagan Kirk, as I'm looking at it, she has kind of come out of nowhere. in a way, for the Scepters and has been spectacular, especially recently coming out of the Olympic break. What are your thoughts on the Toronto Scepters and Kirk coming into her own this season?
Well, the Scepters are an interesting Jekyll and Hyde team. I mean, we don't have that much time, but if I can condense briefly the team that I cover, just in terms of, well, in terms of Kirk, first of all, it was like going into the season, it was unclear, and even up to the Olympic break, was Kirk going to be your number one, or is Verlaine Tuley going to be your number one? And they between Gina Kingsbury, general manager, and coach Troy Ryan, they would not name a number one, and that's the way it progressed up to the Olympic break. And then after the Olympic break, it seems like Kirk has just taken that team on her shoulders and just, as you said, been playing phenomenally and is now just emerged as a true starter. So in terms of the team itself going up to the Olympic break, oh my gosh, they were terrible. And it's like for hockeyhotstove.com, I one of the last PWHL articles I wrote before the Olympics was, my goodness, somebody please save the Scepters, because they were last in goals for, they were last in number of goals given up against. They were just not a very good team heading in. And I'm as we sit here, with all teams having played 22 games and the Scepters in fourth place, that's actually a pleasant surprise, because the Scepters, especially for the Olympians who had to go over, had a really strange schedule in that they were out west, and then they went, and then the Olympic break. So the members, the eight Scepters of the team, well, nine if you count Kristin De La Rovere, who what didn't sign until after the break, but all went over to Italy. And then when they came back, they started on the road again in the Pacific Northwest, going out to back to Vancouver and Seattle. And then they start going on this win streak, and now you wake up, this morning, with all teams having played the same number of games, and the Scepters are now in fourth place. So I don't know if Troy Ryan and Gina Kingsbury read my article and said, "Somebody please save the Scepters." But it's been a pleasant surprise to see them bounce back the way they have after after a very di abysmal pre Olympic start to their season. It's like their second half is now a it's almost a new in a season entirely. Can they keep this up? Like I said, between Ottawa and New York and Toronto, it's going to be a dogfight for that fourth and final spot. But yeah, of course, because it's a team I could go on I cover, I could go on about them. But I think maybe Troy Ryan has got them finally getting into the good habits. As opposed to, you'd hear him after scrum, oh, sorry, scrum, post game availability lamenting at the bad line changes. How do teams at this level have not be able to make a, something as fundamental as a line change? It's like they've cleaned up their fundamentals, and I think that's between that and as you said, the emergence of Reagan Kirk as number one has been the part of that part of the bigger picture that has vaulted them into the position that they are now, that Toronto fans hope they can hold on to that spot over the last eight games.
Well, and not only that, but it would give them a team to root for in the playoffs because we all know that the Maple Leafs ain't making it.
Yeah. Oh, so you read my article too.
Yeah. So.
The Toronto Scepters aren't the only team, that Toronto team that's not going to make the playoffs. That was before the Olympics.
Yeah.
That was
So.
my lead.
So interestingly, you're one of many Hockey Hot Stove writers who have come onto the show. It has become a joke that the hockey that hockeyhotstove.com is taking over the more phenomenal hockey show. So, but moving on, we have the Ottawa Charge. Obviously, they're in fifth place right now, but a simple win or overtime loss or overtime win can change that for them right off the bat. What are your thoughts on the Ottawa Charge and them kind of having a little, I want to call it a meteoric fall because I don't think that's fair, but they're definitely playing a lot lower to the expectations that we thought they would be playing to after making it to the Walter Cup championship last season. So what are your thoughts on the Charge right now? And by any chance, do you think that the talk about the arena situation could be a distraction for that locker room?
Well, it's it a lot of to answer your question really depends on the expectations going into the third season, because like for myself, Gwyneth Phillips, standing on her head, almost single-handedly winning that Walter Cup for the Charge. But then you look at the playoff, the numbers, and it's kind of like Phillips standing on her head, taking all four games, to a 2-1 overtime result. I don't know if you'll ever see that again. But then if you look at the Charge as a whole on what they did in last year's Walter Cup playoffs, I mean, all the credit in the world to Gwyneth Phillips and the defense in front of her, but the offense just kind of dried up. They did not score a lot of goals. So then when you take into account going into year three, my preseason prediction for Ottawa was, well, it really depends on who can step up in terms of like who basically, I mean, who's going to get the puck to Brienne Jenner, and it's like where's all the scoring going to come from? So to pleasant surprises of Charge fans, and to Rebecca Leslie, who's like, I mean, had cups of coffee here and there and everywhere, and now she's a just having a career year, just emerging into a one of her own. I mean, former Toronto Scepter, she in the inaugural season had played 24 games, had 9 points, and then regressed really last year, 3 points in 27 games with the Charge last season. And all of a sudden, it's like, how is she tied for fourth in league scoring with Jenner? It's like she's just come into her own. She's just taken off like a rocket. So, and then Phillips, I mean, she had a phenomenal, playoff last year, with the number two goalie behind Frankel for the gold medal U.S. Olympic winning team. So maybe, like, I mean, she's like a 1C step behind Frankel and Debian, as we've been talking about, if you look at the stats. But I mean, certainly capable of carrying a team on her own, as we saw in the playoffs. It's like, can we expect that every year? I guess is just the question that the Charge fans have to answer if they want to overtake Toronto I will look at the arena situation this way. I think it'll galvanize them. I think for all the distractions that between the Lansdowne and the LeBreton and the Oseg going back and forth, I think if anything, the arena situation might just serve as a rallying point for the Charge to say, hey, I mean, if we if we like, I mean, in the extreme scenario, I mean, he's like, I mean, where if they had to pick up and move or something like that. But I mean, can we just, I mean, have one last hurrah for our fans? I mean, I'm not saying a move is imminent, but I think it can be a rallying cry.
Next up, we got the New York Sirens, who are in sixth place. And again, this is one where one regulation win, they're tied. Actually, they would surpass the Ottawa Charge because of all the teams, regulation wins, Ottawa has the fewest. They have five, whereas the Sirens have eight. New York Sirens, they're actually not at the bottom of the barrel. It took expansion teams to make it happen in a way, but they're not at the bottom. They're playing, I think, quite frankly, they're 8-0, 3-11 when you do the standings in the order of wins, overtime losses, and losses. So they're still not there. But what improvements have you seen the Sirens do this going into this season, and what could you potentially expect out of them in these final eight games?
Yeah, well, I mean it. I mean, so you see Pascal Daou mortgage the defense when he traded away, Ellis Shelton, and to get that number two overall pick to get to Casey O'Brien. But between O'Brien and, of course, the sorry, number three overall, two was Boston. Number three overall was Casey O'Brien. But of course, number one overall was the phenom Kristina Kaltenkova. So it's basically mortgaging the what was a potent defense, which is still adequate. I'll get to that in a second. But to have your young guns, it's like, Kaltenkova and Casey O'Brien, your rookie forwards, being complemented by Sarah Filley up top, So in just in terms of getting the scoring, like I said, they have 50 goals. So I mean, they're okay. So they're middle of the pack in terms of their output. But Kalton Kova, I mean, it's like for a player to not just lead or be towards the top of the league, not just as a rookie, but she has 11 goals. I think Kelly Panik is the only one that has more yet. Okay, goals. There's Kelly Panik 12. You know, Rebecca Leslie, as I mentioned, 12, and then Kalton Kova is just number three in the league with 11 goals. It's in terms of the improvements. Yeah, they've got more. So they've got players who can put the puck in the net, but no, it's kind of come at the expense of the defense, because when you lose someone like Ellis Shelton, that it's kind of hard to overcome now. I mean, of course they've got an adequate defense. I mean, that's led by Zandy Hart, and then you've got they protected Maya Nylund-Pearson, and Bourbonnais good on the back end with the Jincy Rose, but it's I think it's going to be like New it's interesting. New York is the only original six team that has yet to make the playoffs, and like it's going to take some good puck bounces going their way to overtake both Ottawa and Toronto to squeak in. So if I mean, I wrote at the beginning, my preseason review had coming back full circle. Pascal Daou is mortgaging, is really rolling the dice. He's literally doubling down when he hopes that O'Brien and Kalton Kova can overcome what New York lost on the back end. And if the Sirens make it, are on the outside looking in for a third straight season, I'm not sure whether it's going to be time for a change at the management in New York. But basically, it's what that gamble's gonna. It is turning out to come down to, and now that they're sixth overall, I mean, it's like you mentioned off the top, it's like they're not at the bottom, but only because there's two expansion teams below them. So, yeah, it's gonna take a lot, but it's still within 4 points. So that's if you want to use a baseball analogy, a game and a half per se, if you want to equate regulation points to games behind. So there's still time. It's gonna again, like with every team, it's gonna come down to what happens in the last 8 games.
Yeah, and it should be noted for the Sirens, they're the only team this season without an overtime win.
Wow.
They are the only team. They have 8 regulation wins, none in overtime. They've lost 3 in overtime, and they've lost 11 in regulation, which is the second most, tied with the Vancouver Golden Eyes, the most going to the Seattle Torrent with 13 losses in regulation. So it's a very interesting season for the Sirens, for one that many were kind of hoping would, as you said, with that gamble, take that step forward. Next up, we do have the expansion Vancouver Golden Eyes. They have 24 points in the standings. They are second to last. This was a team, when we pull up this roster, you had mentioned Sarah Nurse earlier. You also have Hannah Miller, who went there, Madison Samoskevich, Sophie J Jax, Claire Thompson, which were the two defenders from the Minnesota Frost. They got Kristen Campbell in net and Emerance Mashmeyer in net as well. So you have a good 1-2 punch in goal for them. They have some pretty darn good defenders and forwards. But it just feels like it just hasn't meshed. Would you say that's a fair sentiment? And we'll probably say the same thing for Seattle in a moment. But do you think that's a fair sentiment? And what can Vancouver do to really kind of close out this season with a little bit of a bang?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like we said with both expansion teams at the top, it's like the expectation on paper is like both of them should have been in the mix for a playoff spot, and that didn't happen. So, in terms of we'll review Vancouver first, but I think Sarah Nurse's injury off the top really set the team back. Not that any one team should rely on one person solely for their scoring. But I mean, when you lose someone of the intangibles of Sarah Nurse, that put a crink in the armor. And then now, Hannah Miller, a player that I like, I don't know, just hasn't seemed to find the stride. And in terms of their goaltending, I mean, they're middle of the pack. I mean, Kristen Campbell, I mean, she needed a fresh start because she was goaltender of the year in the first year of the PWHL, and then second season it was like kind of like maybe not as dominant, but where Soupy Campbell's Achilles heel was, if you're a Raptors fan, if you watch any of the games in Toronto, it was the playoffs. And it's just shoot straight. She did not play very well in the playoffs, so she just in either of the first two seasons, so she just needed a fresh start. And right now, so she's sixth in goals against average, middle of the pack. And Mashmeyer, it's an adequate 1-2 punch over there, but it's again, I think it's just they've just had trouble putting in the puck in the net. Again, not that everything should go through Sarah Nurse, but 41 goals scored is the lowest total in the league. And I think it's just Brian Nadolski just hasn't found a way to get that offense going.
Yeah, and of course, you mentioned 41 goals forward is the lowest in the league. Second lowest is 43 by the Scepters, 45 by the Seattle Torrent. So, which is a great segue into the Torrent. Again, you mentioned Hillary Knight, Hannah Bilka. Alex Carpenter was one of the players who went over as well. They recently traded for Teresa Schaffzall.
Shapzol,
Yeah, Schaffzall from Boston, not that long ago. Their defense has Emily Zumwinkel, Maria Coppola, oh, Coppel, Emily Brown, Kayla Barnes, and then you have Corinne Schroeder, Carly Jackson, and Hannah Murphy in goal for the Torrent. Which, by the way, full disclosure, I'm a huge Carly Jackson fan. Love him.
Oh. I'm a huge CJ fan. She played she was a huge fan favorite in Toronto. Even though she played like only like maybe one, two games, but yeah, how can you
So
not love CJ?
I have it right here, but I have the Upper Deck Game Day Moments debut card for CJ from last season. So that tells you how much of a fan I am to go out and get the debut card for them. But
For sure.
when you look at the Torrent, we just talked about the Golden Eyes and how they just haven't really gotten it to work, especially with how the expansion draft was to kind of top load these teams. What are your thoughts on the Seattle Torrent as a whole when you look at that roster, what they've done, having the third lowest amount of goals forward and are in last place, and they actually have the most losses in the league and regulation in the league?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a quandary. I mean, it's like you've got those Olympians, like you said. I mean, Knight and Carpenter, Bilka. It's like what well, there's this is a team that shouldn't have trouble scoring, but just the chemistry hasn't been there. And I mean, of course, Knight being injured after the Olympics doesn't help. And then also, I think you also have to look in goal too. I mean, it's like Schrader was like, I mean, was a workhorse for the New York Sirens, and then when she went over to Seattle in the off season, it just hasn't the numbers just don't be, she's taken a step back just in terms of the numbers. I mean, in terms of a 2.64 GAA and a save percentage 908, which are subpar, to put it bluntly. I mean, that GAA is good for only a 10th overall among eligible goaltenders in the league. And then behind her, the Hannah Murphy seems to be molding into the number two role on the depth chart ahead of CJ. She's a 12th in that category. So yeah, it's and so to bring it back, I mean, it's no surprise if the goaltending has been subpar. They have surrendered 65 goals against as a whole, which is the highest goals allowed of any of the eight teams. So it's whether I guess to bring it back to what I said about the Scepters, I mean they had the pre-Olympic break where it was the Scepters who had given up the most goals per game, and then now it's Seattle, and the difference there is like I mean Toronto has had a Reagan Kirk epiphany where she's just taken it on Kirk that is, and been able to shut the door. So would either Schroeder or Murphy be able to do the same for the Torrent to have even remote chance of maybe getting back into the race? If so, that would be a prerequisite for Seattle to have any thoughts of entertaining any playoff berth, which I don't think anybody believes that that's going to happen. But strange, they're so 9 points out, so that's pretty much 3 games back if you use the baseball analogy again. But with 3 teams to pass before they even get, the Torrent would even get to Toronto, seems pretty far-fetched. But for the Torrent, it starts of course in goal, and then working from that outside, it's with players like we said with Hillary Knight, with Carpenter, they Serdachny, they should be able to score. But actually not now that Serdachny, I think in Knight's absence, has been elevated to that to that top line. Maybe she can get going after what was a mediocre season in Ottawa. So yeah, if the goals can start coming from other sources, which they would have to be in Knight's absence, then that's how Seattle can turn it around.
Now, of course, one of the interesting things about the PWHL is that once you are eliminated from playoff contention, wins matter in a way because that generates points towards getting the first overall pick in the draft. So if you're the Torrent, maybe you lose that one or two more games to get eliminated, so you have 6 games that you can use to work towards, getting that first overall pick, and maybe to say, hey, this season's lost, but this gives us something to play for. Same can go with the Golden Eyes. This gives us something to play for, to really maybe that's what sometimes you need to create that gel that goes into the following season. It's like to build off of. What are your thoughts in regards to that? Because just looking at the standings and the true situation of what really those two teams are in, more so the Torrent right now than the Golden Eyes, because the Golden Eyes can do a slight little flip.
Well, I'm not quite sure you can sort of pull off a mini tank slash reversal because of based on the I guess it's called the gold plan where the points don't accumulate towards that first overall pick until you get eliminated from the playoffs. So, like it's a bit different than the NHL where a team can like quote unquote tank and try and get and maximize their lottery odds. And of course, the Leafs aren't doing it properly because they play like crap and they play so indifferently coming out of the Olympics. And now that they have a chance to tank and fall into the bottom five so that they can at least keep their draft pick, then they all of a sudden start winning. So the Leafs aren't doing it right. They're a poor example. But to answer to Seattle, can Seattle just say, okay, let's get eliminated and then try to turn it on? I don't know. And not specific to Seattle. I don't know that that's necessarily a formula at any team. It's kind of hard to say, okay, we're going to play indifferently for X number of games, and then okay, now we're going to start turning on the Jets, because I mean that's not to necessarily say that you're going to win if you turn on the Jets, but I mean, I will say that's it's an interesting PWHL has always been innovative in terms of like the escape rule, the jailbreak rule, the and of course in this case the gold plan where you can't just tank or once you're eliminated then at least it gives the eliminated teams something to play for. It'd be interesting if the NHL could somehow take a hybrid of that and make it more interesting for the middle of the pack teams, again using the Leafs as an example. It's like can they can you get like a team like in the middle of a bubble team, make the games more interesting? But anyway, that's a whole can of worms. But
Well, in all fairness, I would say this as a Washington Capitals fan. I mean, I could see the Capitals on the last day of the regular season playing spoiler to the Columbus Blue Jackets. Now imagine if they had the same thing, if they'd been eliminated from the playoff contention, which they haven't officially yet. That could depend on how things go tonight in Utah. I mean, everyone always talks about like the teams playing spoiler for teams trying to get into the playoffs, and that's a motivating factor. It's like, oh, these guys are in our division. We don't want to see them make the playoffs,
For sure.
type of deal. So it's like, in a way, it's like with the gold plan, or that's a motivating factor. But it's like, hey, we could win this game to help our odds of getting that first overall pick, but we could also play spoiler, say, against the Charge or the Sirens from getting into the playoffs too. So it's like you can create it where it's like there's multiple factors that make us go, ooh, we could play spoiler and potentially get the first overall pick. That's a little enticing right there, if you ask me.
Yeah, it is enticing. It makes it more fun. Again, it speaks more to innovation. I mean, there's going to be, imperfections, with any system, but I mean, it just speaks more to like the PWHL between, Amy Shear, Jana Hefford, in terms of how can we, how can we implement things that'll make it that other sports leagues, not just hockey, but other sports leagues don't necessarily do, and which kind of segues into, like, I mean, if you want to talk about innovation and the various rules, also the mandate such that the first place team actually gets to choose its first round opponent. I think that's kind of enticing, as well. So
But how truly effective has that worked out in the first 2 years for the team that's picked their poison?
Yeah,
But
but just to have the option.
yeah.
It's probably shot themselves in the foot, but so let's say it's Boston this year. It's like, I mean, do you want to face the Scepters, or
Or the
if
Frost.
or the Frost, or Montreal? It's all things being equal, if they had to choose between Toronto and Minnesota, it's at least having the option. I mean, it's like, there's only you choose from one or two teams, but it's I think it makes for interesting conversation, that's for sure.
Yeah, although I'm in the camp of a lot of the players and general managers of the NHL, we need 1v8 back in the playoffs.
Oh,
100%.
that's
Yeah. Yeah, we need 1v8 back in the playoffs so badly. But that's the NHL. But I will say this about the NHL though, when it comes to the PWHL, is that in the last players poll, 35% said that they wanted the jailbreak rule in the NHL. And then the number two thing that was voted on was the standings points. Because having 3 points for a regulation win, two for an overtime win, one for an overtime loss, and zero for a regulation loss makes a whole lot more sense than how it is right now.
Oh yeah, I mean, for the first two, like, I mean, very brief. I mean, Jeff Merrick, has been advocating, like, he didn't call it the jailbreak rule when he was when he had the podcast with Sportsnet, when he was 32 Thoughts, or I think even before that, I think even before 32 Thoughts, he with M versus W, Merrick versus Wyshynski, Jeff Merrick has been audit ad advocating for the player to come out of the penalty box on a shorthanded goal for at least months, if not years, before it was actually called the jailbreak. So,
Oh, definitely years, because I remember Merrick definitely was talking about on I know he always tried every chance he got to talk about it on the 32 Thoughts podcast with Elliot Friedman. So I know definitely there. So yeah, he's been saying it for a few years before it became the jailbreak rule. And no, and it's a great incentive because it puts onus on the team with the power play to to try to score, and not, and it puts more onus on the defensive team to attack more. And I remember recently being at a Caps game, and on the same power play, the Caps gave up two shorthanded goals on the same power play. And I remember leaning over to my season ticket holder seat neighbor going like, if this was the PWHL, that power play would have been over.
Yeah, or the drawback is, like, I mean, you'll never score. I mean, Theo Fleury, I can't remember what year it was, but he scored a hat trick on one penalty kill. You'll never see anything else like that again. But if the jailbreak rule was in place, to your point, then that wouldn't happen. So, yeah. So between the jailbreak and, of course, very quickly on 3-2-1-0. Oh, I mean, when that overtime point came into play, I think what 2000 or 2001. It's like anybody.
2005, I think, was when they initiated the shootout. The 2005-2006 season was the first one with the shootout, and that's when it
But the
became
shootout,
the.
but OTL was, I think, a few years before that. But regardless of the year, it's like you could see it coming a mile away, where all the standings would get all jumbled up, and it's like, it's especially when two like bubble playoff teams have to play each other, and all they have to do is play to regulation that guarantees them at least a point. It's like, oh my gosh, it's just so convoluted. So yeah, 3-2-1-0. I mean, you could see that coming. Or you could see the advocacy for that system coming, like, a mile away, because we just know what as soon as the quote unquote loser point came into play in the NHL, that was just going to be total chaos. And now maybe Mr. Merrick loves chaos. He's always said that. But it's yeah. The I mean, I like the way it's like, here's 3 points available, and 3 points exclusively one way or the other. No, 3-0, 2-1, 1-2, or 0-3. Not the proverbial 3-pointer after regulation, like in the NHL. No, it's yeah. I just love that that the system, the way the PWHL does it.
Yeah, and not only that, but I believe that's also the system of which how it works in soccer too.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's like they made it make sense. Why can't we get it in the NHL? But with that, we're moving on to the next thing, and that is the Takeover Tour and expansion. The Takeover Tour this year has been very successful. I was actually at the game in Washington, D.C. between New York and Montreal, where we had set the I believe it's the US attendance record for a women's hockey game. Was a great experience to be at. Wish I was in the press box, but it is what it is. But when you look at the Takeover Tour, you can't look at it without talking about expansion, because that's how Vancouver and Seattle came about, because of the success that those two cities had with the Takeover Tour. Having conversations with the people that I've had, they always ask me, what are my thoughts on expansion? I've always said that if they expand, because we know Amy Shear has said that they're going to go up to 12 teams, that's the game plan to get the 12 and then hold steady there for a while. I see it where the four teams have to be out west. As great as success that Washington, D.C. had, I cannot see DC getting an expansion team right now, because you have this issue logistically with travel. Because you have Seattle and Vancouver on the West Coast, and the closest team to them is Minnesota. So in my mind, I kind of see it where it's Calgary, Edmonton, Denver, and maybe Detroit, Chicago, or Dallas as one of those fourth teams. Because that is how you would spread out some of that travel logistics to make it a little easier on the league. And that way you can also create a Western division and an Eastern division at the same time too. What are your thoughts on everything with the Takeover Tour and expansion, and my crazy thoughts on how to maybe fix the travel logistics by just expanding out west first before moving to Pittsburgh, DC, Nashville, and Carolina? So.
So, well, thoughts on the Takeover Tour. I mean, it's it's of course hugely successful, and you maybe you don't necessarily measure success in terms of high attendance, but in terms of gauging attendance. So it's like it's twofold. It brings the markets, it brings the games to non-PWHL markets, but also to gauge potential success. So I mean, it's like when so we have substandard crowds in places like Buffalo and Pittsburgh over the past couple of years. I don't think they pretty much, by their attendance or lack of it, said PWHL team's not going to be coming into those sub 10. I think 10,000 has to be the threshold. If you've got a 4-digit crowd, you know what I mean, you're not getting in. But It's interesting that you bring up the question about expansion, because when before the takeover games were announced, before the season started, I wrote for Hockey Hot Stove my predictions for where the next four would be, because the it came just after Dave Pignotta of the Fourth Period broke the story, like that to your point about Amy Shear suggesting that we want to go to four teams within the next couple of years. So I gave my personal thoughts assessing what had been the first 2 years of takeover tours, assessing arena availability, and assessing rivalries. So I had to take all those into my head and account for and justify my predictions of where I thought it would be going. So I think we were agreed on three of the four teams. I mean, I had predicted, or my and I'm still predicting.
All this is predicting right now
Yeah,
at this point.
of course it is. Okay. Yeah, my opinion plus $3 will get you a ride on the subway. But I'm predicting what I said in my article, which Calgary, Denver, Detroit, and Quebec City. So I can go into any of them individually, but on a high level, it's like number one, it preserves a equal balance of Canadian and U.S. teams. So you have two going to Canada, two going to the States. So it suffices the arena availability in all four markets, and all four markets have had good takeover success. And in terms of, okay, let's if we want to go to geography, I think we're agreed on Calgary, Denver, and then you had that wild card in there where you thought Detroit was in a wild card. So wild card. So if you look at it geographically from east to west type of thing, then I think Detroit and Quebec City, I mean, sort of like in the Eastern time zones, I said off the top, natural rivals. I had Quebec City in there because they had a very successful takeover tour game, and they got a great arena in the Videotron Center, and it creates that natural rivalry over there with of course with Ottawa and Montreal. And then Detroit hosted two takeover game tour games in 2024, 2025, and they were both hugely successful, and they had the record at the time before it was broken by Seattle and then Washington, as you said. But
And then
Detroit,
Seattle got it back
yeah,
immediately after the Olympics. So
but before Seattle and Washington, Detroit had it, and then Detroit broke their own record the next year that they hosted it. So I put Detroit in that into that mix as well. So maybe it might not satisfy your as far west criteria, but I think, in my opinion, having those four, maybe not looking at necessarily one market individually, but as a whole, kind of like when you have Seattle and Vancouver type of thing, right? You got to take those two as a cousins. And I think that the way I'd had it set up, Calgary, Denver, Detroit, Quebec City, kind of makes sense for the international piece, but also as a east-west type of thing. Again, it's imperfect, but it's better options than, as you said, for Washington, for the reasons that you said. No disrespect to Washington, or no disrespect to Halifax. I love Halifax. I love going to Halifax and visiting there. I covered the 2019 Memorial Cup there. Great city, and they had great fans that hosted two games this year, and they have a great arena. I'd be more comfortable with Halifax if they had an American cousin equivalent to your point about logistics, like Portland, Maine, or something like that. I mean, you already got a Boston team, but you need a cousin for Halifax, just like Vancouver and Seattle make natural cousins. And for that reason, for Halifax being out there all on its own, it's nothing to do with the market. It's got nothing to do with the arena or the fans. They have all that thing, all those factors. But it to be on its lonesome all by itself and trying to measure the logistics of going to Halifax and then as potentially as far away as Vancouver or Seattle, unless you can get a cousin for Halifax, that's going to be a tough sell, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like you said, the cousins, like I kind of put Edmonton and Calgary together because let's be honest, we all love the Battle of Alberta in the
Of course.
NHL. Who wouldn't love a Battle of Alberta in the PWHL? So we're both kind of on the same wavelength, like two teams are going to be in Canada, two teams are going to be in the US. One thing I've always said, because there's the ongoing conversation about Ottawa and their arena situation, as we talked about earlier, like I could see DC getting a team via relocation if they're not one of the expansion cities. And Ottawa obviously being the team that would be talked about because, as Amy Shear noted before the season and the media availability, like all options are on the table. Obviously, the number one goal is to keep the charge in Ottawa. But if it becomes with whatever the arena project and, you know, they're not getting the type of arena that they want for the charge, you know, those options are going to be on the table, you know. But like, I obviously this season, when you look at the takeover tour, and I'm talking about this season only, Chicago, Detroit, and Denver, and as you mentioned, Halifax, all got two games each. And so when you look at that, you know, that kind of plays a factor, especially if like if they've hosted in years prior, like you mentioned with Detroit. So that kind of gives you that indicator, like, okay, it's not official, but we see some signs. So it's definitely it, I'm definitely intrigued to see what they do. You know, do they do two this year and then two next year to get to that 12 team max that they want to be at for a little bit? Or do they do all four and then, man, good luck with expansion draft on that one.
Well, you know, I was about to say, it's kind of like, you know, the logistics of that. I mean, the first wave, all the criticism it got from people like me, especially me, how much more complex if it is with four teams and the protection and yeah, I mean, I can see a two and two as opposed to four at once, but for the reasons we stated, but like, I mean, who knows? I mean, especially with the influx of players coming, I mean, not necessarily from like NCAA, but you know, influx of like European players as well. Yeah, I think it's more to the point of protecting the fan base and you know, the stability of the rosters. But I mean, if the first wave of expansion proved anything, I guess that's not really as big of a priority in the minds of the people who run the PWHL, and that's it's their
Yeah,
league.
and actually, and you mentioned the a wave of Europeans. That's something that I've overheard. I think it might have been Hillary Knight or some others, where they're like, you know, we kind of want more of the Europeans to come over and play in the PWHL because that will make their players better going into the next Olympics and international competitions in general, because now they're playing with the best, kind of like how it is with the NHL, the best play in the NHL. And now they're getting to learn by playing with the best, which then makes Sweden, Slovakia, Czechia, Finland much, much better going into that next Olympics. And so having those four teams that can help with that influx of European talent coming into the PWHL, big time right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science. I mean, it's not necessarily just specific to women's hockey or hockey in general, but it's just no matter what sport. I mean, you have to play among the best to be the best, and it's like, and of course you know, the challenge, you know, in the big picture is like you want the teams, like you just said, the European teams, Sweden, Finland, all those Switzerland, all those teams, to be competitive to, and maybe just you know, eventually, like, I mean, close the gap between the European teams and the North American teams in terms of, so that it's not always Canada, United States playing for that Olympic gold medal. You had the one exception happened in 2006 where the Swedish goalie Kim Martin stood on her head in the shootout. That was the lone exception. And of course, the challenge with that is, of course, as the Swedes get better, as the Finns get better, and as the Swiss get better, well, guess what? Canada and the United States get better as well, and that's where the it just becomes so hard to close the gap. But I mean, if this wave of proposed wave of European influx, you know, eventually makes its way to the PWHL, like we said, it can only help those countries. And then you know, maybe before too long, you know, maybe we'll see another upset at the Olympics. Maybe hopefully not at, well, I'm speaking from north of the border, so I'm going to say hopefully not at the expense of Canada. I'm still reeling from last month's loss, but you know, congratulations to everybody south of the border. You earned it. So, but yeah,
So,
it's
fun fact about me.
yep.
Guess how much Olympic hockey I watched?
Now, the way you're setting up the question, I'm saying zero.
I mean, I paid attention to the women's game a bit. I wasn't able to watch For everyone who knows, I've been unemployed for over a year now. And so I'm doing Instacart to pay the bills. And when the games are going on, I'm actually out doing Instacart. NHL, the men's one was actually out of protest because I'm adamantly against the NHL shutting down for international competitions because it makes their season seem irrelevant. And same with the Stanley Cup final or playoffs, because as we saw last year with the Four Nations, it's a short term. Great success. Long term, didn't do the job what it was supposed to do, which was bring more people into the NHL and watch that race to the playoffs and the playoffs themselves. So it didn't succeed with what it was meant to do. I know I get so much hate for it online, and I gratefully accept it.
No, I mean, I can certainly, I can, you're not wrong. I mean, it's, if especially you talk to general managers. I mean, I remember talking to Jimmy Devilano one time, and it's like he just went on a 2-minute rant about how, his players, for the Detroit Red Wings would go overseas and run the risk of injury for what essentially has very little compensation available to the general managers in the event of such a thing. But and of course, and I mean, even Kenny Campbell from the Hockey News, every time he references the World Cup of Hockey, he always puts as a sarcastic TM after the tournament name in his articles because it's like trademark. It's like because it's everything's such a money grab. But then, I can certainly respect and even agree with the principle. But I'm one of those guys. It's like but yeah, when the puck drops, it's like it's like I mean, the last year's Four Nations, like yeah, this is gonna be a money grab, and then. When Canada played that first game and you got that bing bang play, MacKinnon to Crosby, it's like against the United States in the preliminary game. Okay, this is going to be fun to watch. I can get on board with this. Screw my principles, throw them out the window. I'm going to watch really good hockey, and I stand by that. So there you go.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'll put it like this. I enjoyed the break because there's only two people who run txhthockey.com, and we can only stretch ourselves so far. For any break we can get, we'll take the break.
Yeah, for
So,
sure.
but with that, Rob, this has been awesome. I've been trying to get PWHL talk on the podcast since before the NHL and PWHL season started.
Okay.
So I'm extremely happy to finally be able to talk PWHL on the podcast.
No, it's my
So I
pleasure.
definitely hope to have you on again. But before we go, where can the people find you on social media and where they can find your work?
Okay, so hockeyhotstove.com. As we've mentioned several times on the site, that's where my primary outlet for my coverage is primarily with the Toronto Raptors of the PWHL. I'll contribute with the odd NHL and Maple Leafs content here and there. I am based in Toronto. My primary focus is on the Raptors. So if you go to hockeyhotstove.com, you find my author tag. You can filter my articles by my name, and then you can find my name to search for me on social media channels. I'm pretty easy to spot. So yeah, look forward to anybody who wants to chat.
All right, and of course, as always, you can follow me on social media at the Lindenbaum 75, and of course, TXHT at TXHT underscore hockey. Go to the website TXHTHockey.com for all hockey content that we do, whether it's jersey tracking, dailies, or everything in between. So with that, I am Michael. He is Rob. Thank you for tuning into the More Phenomenal Hockey Show, and until next time, we will see you on the ice.